Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Public transportation and transit-oriented development have been credited for reducing traffic congestion and reducing pollution. A joint research project by UC Berkeley and Rutgers University also shows a link between transit expansion and economic development. UC Berkeley's Daniel Chapman analyzed 300 metropolitan areas across the U.S. and found that a 10% expansion in transit services would result in a wage increase of between $53 and $194 per worker per year. And a new report by Reconnecting America also found that while low-income workers face multiple barriers to career advancement, the economic and workforce development fields often overlook a key barrier for these workers, and that is access to transit. And then in turn, transit advocates often overlook the importance of job creation and training to build a stronger economy. So on today's Your Call, we continue our Agenda for a New Economy series by talking about how public transportation affects economic mobility. What is the best model for a transit-oriented urban development, and where can we look to find successful models? Today, we're joined by Dan Chapman. He's an assistant professor of city and regional planning at UC Berkeley and co-author of the study Transit Service, Physical Agglomeration, and Productivity in U.S. Metropolitan Areas. And he joins us from his office at Berkeley. Hi, Dan. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Nice to have you. And Jeff Wood is the new media director and chief cartographer at Reconnecting America, a national organization focusing on the links between transportation and community development. Hi, Jeff. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me as well.
So, Jeff, why don't we start off with you? When you look at the state of public transportation across the country, especially in larger cities, how good is it? I know it's been improving since the mid-90s, but where are we today?
I think it's getting better. We see a lot of new investment in transit lines as well as new investment in transit as well. And I was telling you earlier about an example from Charlotte where in 1998 they passed a Hefson sales tax, which a lot of local folks would focus on the light rail investment that was made from that sales tax, but also they invested in the bus system and increased ridership by 100%. So we're seeing a lot of investment around the country in transit ridership, but it's obviously nowhere near where it needs to be, but it's steadily increasing.
So in Charlotte, North Carolina, once they invested, they increased ridership by 100%?
That's right.
That's massive. Was that expected?
I don't know if it was expected, but I think that's what they were trying to do. They were trying to increase ridership from the region and not just in the city.
And then was this access, was it available in low-income communities, and do you know how that affected those communities?
So it actually did. The ridership increase came from partly from the center city, from increasing headways and on frequent routes. And so what it did was allowed lower income folks to connect to places like downtown and other employment centers.
And Jeff, if you can speak up a bit, we have a kind of a low line with you.
Sorry.
Okay, that's much better. Thank you. And so how does this connect to economic mobility when you're looking at access to public transit?
Well, it makes a huge difference because, low-income folks have issues with, their budgets anyway. So the housing plus transportation connection is huge, and saving money on transportation is a big bonus for folks that are looking to connect to work and as well as other areas.
And Dan, today's program came out of an op-ed by the New York Times' Paul Krugman, and he points to a study that shows the variation of social mobility across cities, and specifically looking in Atlanta in poor and rich neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. They're far apart because everything's far apart, apparently. And
yeah.
The relationship between sprawl and social mobility reinforces the case for, quote, smart growth urban strategies. But it bears on a larger debate about what's happening to societies, especially in cities with a lot of sprawl. So how do you see the connections between public transit, sprawl, and economic mobility?
I think, just to start off, I think an historical perspective is helpful here. Transit investments, rail investments, streetcar investments historically in the United States have been part of what led to a very dispersed urban form. And so, in fact, when we talk about sprawl, we have to acknowledge the fact that the kinds of investments that we make in transit can actually lead to more sprawl. So it isn't entirely a question of transit making a compact core and making things more dense. And it depends entirely upon how the transit system is managed and where it goes and all those sorts of things. And so Los Angeles is the poster child of sprawl in some sense, and yet its urban form is really dictated by the Pacific Interurban Railway and not by the automobile. So it is a bit more complex, I think, than Krugman, who I admire a great deal, portrayed in his op-ed, which, you know, this isn't exactly his area of expertise. And so no offense to him at all. I think he characterized the work that he was summarizing fairly well. It's just that, you know, there are, you know, picking up on Jeff's point, it's interesting to note that the advantage of, or the benefits from Charlotte's investments were largely due to increases in bus service and not necessarily to increases in rail. And so there are some important distinctions to be made. Whenever we subsidize travel, it will result in people traveling more. And we subsidize travel in all kinds of ways, including our transit investments and our road investments. And there are, the results of that can be pretty, in a way, pretty predictable with respect to land use and sprawl.
Yeah, it's interesting because the Krugman article, it actually did spark a pretty decent conversation. I mean, if you read the comments, a lot of people are talking about how they want more access to public transportation. And study after study shows that the majority of Americans believe that more taxpayer dollars should go to public transportation.
You know, which is very true. And you know, Jeff, I don't know if you've seen this, but there's a sort of almost historical piece that appears in The Onion, the satirical online news magazine, which states 99% of American commuters support paying for public transit for others. And the joke here is that people are willing to pay for public transit, but largely, you know, don't use it. The share of public transit in the very highest share cities is, you know, if it's at 10% for the commute, you're doing great. And it rarely gets above that, and in Charlotte, I'm sure it's far, far below that. And this isn't to say that we shouldn't be making alternative investments in transportation, particularly for the less well-off. But it begs the question about how to do it and how to do it less or more efficiently.
Why is that percentage so low?
Well, it's low for a pretty obvious reason. It's that the real cost of auto use and ownership has declined every year and continues to decline. And, you know, there are some increases in gas prices that are happening, but if you look at the inflation-adjusted value of gas prices, they're just getting back up to the 1974 levels or so. And of course, meanwhile, our vehicles are much, much more fuel efficient, so the per-mile costs of operating those vehicles are low. And, you know, in addition to transit investments, we really sorely need, and I'm sure Jeff will agree with me on this, better ways of charging people for the costs that they impose upon others when they drive and when they use autos.
Jeff, did you want to jump in there?
Well, yeah, I just wanted to mention also that, you know, that 10% number or the number, you know, of people that take transit in a region is affected by how much transit access people have. When you do, you know, there was a Center City study in Philadelphia that came out yesterday that showed that 62% of people, you know, walk, bike, and take transit to the Center City. So it's highly dependent on where you're going as well in terms of how much ridership you can get. But I think that, you know, the problem is that larger regional number, the 5% or the 10% is what we're kind of looking at when we're seeing transit ridership, or at least the mode share.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely, and I would agree 100% that transit has its natural competitive advantage going into the very densest places, and you know that's kind of the basis conceptually for the study that we did in agglomeration, which was looking at the central cities and trying to understand how whether transit investments or transit service improvements, forget the term investment because it seems to imply, you know, we build more stuff or we buy more stuff rather than we just operate it more frequently and we pay for more drivers, which is a different idea. And that those service improvements are associated with higher productivity. We believe it's via densification of central cities, and it's in those places where it's a particular value to be there. People want to be near each other because that's where the action is. That's where the productivity is happening, and that's where the innovations are being made. And transit, I think, can be a part of that and needs to be a part of that. So I'm a big believer in city growth really being impeded by a failure to make good transit investments. But I'm also a skeptic about the benefit of transit in comparison to other modes, such as walking and bicycling, and even carpooling, which in some places carpooling is much more efficient than taking transit in terms of all of its impacts from greenhouse gases on down.
And how does this directly affect low-income communities? Because a few years ago, the Brookings Institute came out with a study called Missed Opportunity, Transit and Jobs in Metropolitan America, and found that most metro area residents can only get to about 30% of jobs within 90 minutes using public transportation. And it's even worse for those seeking low- and middle-skilled jobs. About 25% of those jobs can be reached within that same time frame using public transit. So essentially, Jeff, what this is saying is that if you don't have a car, it's really hard to get one of these jobs. In fact, one study found that more than 40,000 jobs in Wisconsin alone were inaccessible to people who do not have cars.
Yeah, and that's true. The Brookings study showed that quite succinctly. And I think that, you know, there's also another issue, too, is that, you know, our transit systems only operate at certain times of the day, the frequency at least. So there's, shift workers that might work in the middle of the night that can't get on. For example, here in the Bay Area, BART stops at midnight, right? So folks can't get to where they're working. So that's a big impediment, is the service, times as well as the quality.
Is this something that city officials are thinking about or talking about? I don't hear it.
I mean, they are talking about it internally, but I think that there's a big issue in terms of a constituency that's out there, pressing for this type of investment, for the frequency investments, for the transit investments overall. The low-income communities that are the kind of the core transit riders for most regions don't have as big of a voice as some others' constituencies. So it gets harder for them to be heard, as well as harder for politicians to kind of push that as well.
Yeah, I do think there's an issue here as well. I'm agreeing with what Jeff is saying here, that that in addition, transit services are provided by transit agencies. These are typically regional agencies. They're not cities. Cities don't usually provide transit, with some exceptions. And so they're making decisions in terms of a somewhat politicized, of course. I should just say any kind of planning process is fundamentally political, because different people's interests are involved. But that one has this process has ended up focusing on trying to do things to gain political support of a larger public, which often means serving not the core transit riders, who are the poorer folks, but instead trying to serve and retain riders who have options, and trying to grow ridership that way, and to trying to get political support that way. And the idea of passing a sales tax is fundamental, as this becomes a much more common way of funding transit systems. And this is one of the ways that the Bay Area has innovated, in that it's one of the first to really rely on sales taxes to fund transportation generally, and transit specifically. What that means is getting majoritarian support, which in turn means making the sorts of changes or promises that are seen to provide new service, as opposed to strengthening existing services and serving the core group of people that has the highest need. And so it's a kind of a conundrum, but it has resulted in a problem, which is that sales tax-funded transportation investments are regressive. They rely on poorer people paying a higher percentage of their income to fund the system, and it's regressive in that classic economic sense. And it would be preferable to have other ways of funding it, property tax basis or income tax or whatever. And unfortunately, that's just not the way it's happened. It would be nice to have a political will to find other ways of funding this, but this is just another example of one of many examples of poorer people don't have the same representation and the same sort of care about their interests as people who are more connected to the political process and who form the majority.
That is Dan Chapman. He's assistant professor of city and regional planning at UC Berkeley and co-author of the study Transit Service, Physical Agglomeration and Productivity in U.S. Metropolitan Areas. We're also joined by Jeff Wood, new media director and chief cartographer at Reconnecting America, a national organization focused on the links between transportation and community development. And on today's Your Call, we're continuing our Agenda for a New Economy series by talking about the connections between access to public transportation and economic mobility. I mean, it's hard enough if you're living in a low-income community to find a decent-paying job. But if you don't have a way to get to a city center, for example, it's even worse. And I mentioned this Brookings study, but it found that most metro area residents can only get to about 30% of jobs within 90 minutes using public transit. Even worse if those are seeking low and middle-skill jobs. It's really difficult if you don't have a car. So what is it like in your area? If you've lived in different neighborhoods, what is the public transportation system like? How has it affected your ability to get a job? I mean, now we've got people living in Sacramento and working in the Bay Area, for example, and it's incredibly difficult, if not impossible, to take public transportation if that's the case. And then also, what will it take to change this, to convince city leaders to invest in public transit? And what kind of public transit are we talking about? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Ruth Ann in El Cerrito. Hi, Ruth Ann. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. I wanted to, first of all, comment. Thank you very, very much for doing the show. And I wanted to piggyback on when the guest commented on alternate ways of funding transit. I would love it if instead of regressive sales tax, it was based on property tax or income tax. But alas, the guest mentioned that that's not the way it's gone. What I wanted to ask primarily if they had any knowledge on accessible transport other places in the country. In the Bay Area, it's pretty good because BART is very accessible. But I know firsthand that when I've tried living in the East Bay to figure out how I could get to your station, KALW, to meet folks or help out with fund drive, it would literally take all day by public transportation to get there. There's no, I mean, I'm exaggerating to say literally, I think I figured it would take like about 4 or 5 hours. So I'm just, the two-prong, it's one, making it more accessible for places to be on major routes, and then secondly, if the guests have any knowledge of other areas besides the Bay Area. I mean, I've taken the Metro in D.C., which is terrific, and I'm from Boston, and that had a pretty antiquated MTA, which wasn't so accessible, and I was trying to get away from the separate but equal paratransit, which is not mainstreaming people with disabilities on regular public transit. And I didn't know what your knowledge might be of it in other areas of the country, because that would greatly increase people disability chances of securing employment. If you can't get to the job or you can't get there on time, you're not going to keep it.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you, Ruth Ann, and thank you for trying to volunteer with the station. Dan, do you want to take that one first?
Well, I was going to say that I think Jeff might want to discuss specifically the, you know, the aspects of the study that talked about other places. You know, a couple of comments. The first thing is, there, I think that in a democratic political system, there is also this notion of basic rights, and we talk about wanting to try to make sure that people have food and safe food and clean water and all those kinds of things. And then the question becomes, how much do you spend to make sure that people can get wherever they want to go? And because the thing about transit is it costs money, and it can be quite expensive. And it can be all the more expensive if there's only a very few numbers of people riding it. And we do have a problem, which is that we have an urban form which is essentially driven by automobility, by the auto. And serving that urban form with transit is really difficult to do in any sort of cost-effective way. So there isn't a good answer to the question of how can we get from point A to point B in something other than an auto that doesn't involve really big systemic change. And really what we're talking about as well is an entirely different conversation about the extent to which land use policies and metropolitan level kind of governance that relates to how cities make decisions about what they will permit to be built, how those come about, because we all live in neighborhoods where most of us don't want 10-story buildings in them. I live in one in Berkeley where there's been a lot of protests over this. And therefore, we end up with an urban form that ultimately can't be cost-effectively served by transit. So there, you know, and you know, there are examples out there where transit systems are paying several dollars up to and as high as $20 or $30 or $40 per ride for each individual ride that's served on a line. And that isn't sustainable. It isn't sustainable regardless of whether or not there was a substantial minority of people who thought they would benefit, because they might not even be willing to pay for it at those rates. So that's why I think we have to bring in an idea of alternatives to public transportation in some instances. Hmm. And I think that those have to consist of all kinds of things, including some form, I think, of deregulation of privately provided shared transit modes, such as are common in the East Coast, where you have private companies that are running shuttles and that are making them available to the public, because there may be some instances where it's possible to be more flexible, and it's not the same when you're running a public transportation system.
Given the realities, what other changes would you like to see?
Well, I mean, I would like to see this. I would like to see a discussion of deregulation of private shared transit in cities, and we have a lot of regulation about who's allowed to deal with it, who's allowed to provide these services. There's been some controversy over services like Lyft, for example, in San Francisco, because there's a concern about safety and there's a concern about competition as well with other services, public transportation services. And there's been a lot of controversy over the Google transit buses and whether they're making incursions and into the conventional public transit services, as well as, of course, contributing to gentrification and so on. But I do think that these alternative modes and flexible modes are perhaps the wave of the future, and we're going to have to start thinking about how they can help solve some of the problems like the caller was talking about.
And Jeff, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, I think Dan's right about the land use issue too. I think he was just talking about Uber and the Google buses and things like that. I think there's a lot of concern about gentrification and those issues coming in San Francisco. Actually, in my neighborhood, I actually live in Noe Valley, and the buses come fast and furious. But I think that it's also the part of the reason why they're there is because it's a failure of land use regulation, or at least deregulation in the valley and along the peninsula. Because they have to take those shuttles to go to those job centers that are actually far away from places like Caltrain and other transportation alternatives. So the private transit is actually just people are trying to solve a problem that has been created for a long period of time. I also want to go back to something else that the caller mentioned. She was asking about good transit in other cities. There's I think that it depends on land use, but it also depends on kind of the markets that are going on. So strong market cities are going to have, and in the West specifically, are going to have stronger transit systems, and they're going to be able to pay for them. Places like Cleveland and other kind of slower market cities are going to have more of a problem serving the region with transit, because they're going to keep having to slash their budget. Legacy costs like labor and other things are just causing havoc with some of these systems. But when you get to the West, places like Salt Lake City and Denver, they actually have really good bus networks and coverage, and you can actually get to a lot of places in the region. Some of them are investing in light rail, and that's good, but I think that the frequent transit is the biggest important thing to when people need to connect with their jobs. And what happens is these strong market cities, these cities that are growing really quickly, can address those issues, while some of the weaker market cities in other parts of the country, particularly in the Rust Belt and other places, are having trouble.
And that is Jeff Wood. He is New Media Director and Chief Cartographer at Reconnecting America, an organization focusing on the links between transportation and community development. Dan Chapman is Assistant Professor of City and Regional Planning at UC Berkeley. And on today's Your Call, we are talking about public transportation, and specifically how it affects low-income communities. A number of reports find that the economic and workforce development fields overlook transit access, and then transit activists often overlook the importance of job creation. So we'll talk about how to get those two sides to talk to each other and the best way to convince officials to improve public transit. We'll be back after this.
Join in today's conversation on Your Call. The phone number is 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. You can also, if you'd rather, send an email question or comment to feedback@yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have a conversation about racial profiling 12 years after 9/11. We'll talk about who's being profiled still and what it's like to be profiled. Arab and Muslim Americans still make up the largest percentage of the no-fly list. So what's really changed since 9/11? The 12-year anniversary is tomorrow. And then on Thursday, we'll have a conversation with journalist Laura Gottesdiener about her new book, A Dream Foreclosed, Black America and the Fight for a Place to Call Home. She's found that more than 10 million people across the country have been evicted from their homes in the last 6 years, and she focuses on four families who have pushed back against foreclosures. That's Thursday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we continue our Agenda for a New Economy series by talking about the connections between public transportation and economic mobility, especially in low-income communities. And we're joined by Dan Chapman, Assistant Professor of City and Regional Planning at UC Berkeley, and Jeff Wood, New Media Director and Chief Cartographer at Reconnecting America. And we'd love to hear from you. What is it like in your area? If you've lived in a place that has really good transit and bad transit, how has it affected you and your ability to find a good job? And if you have specific examples you'd like to talk about, we'd love to hear from you. And if things have changed in your area, what did it take to change it? And when you're talking about specific transportation, what form do you think should receive more funding and why? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Peter in La Selva Beach. Hi, Peter. Welcome to the show.
Hi there.
Hi. Where is La Selva Beach?
Well, it's in Santa Cruz County.
Okay. Sounds nice.
We're an urban enclave, and we get bus service every 2 hours.
2 hours.
Yeah, every 2 hours, and then you can take a meandering bus ride that'll take you about 50 minutes to get to 41st Avenue, which is a shopping center where it joins with other bus service, and then you can pay for another bus. There's no transfers, and to get anywhere you want to go. And this is, it really makes it so less and less people want to ride the bus when you get so infrequent service, as well as it's, you can't connect up to the express bus, which runs down the freeway only a mile away. Also to the south of La Selva Beach is all the fields, the berry fields, and farm workers can't even access that area at all. There is no bus service along for 7 miles going to Watsonville, which is a low-income community with about 20-25% unemployment. Then these folks, they have to get in cars and drive out to the fields to work because they can't get bus service as well. And meanwhile, we have these express buses running up and down the freeway that don't service the communities adjacent to the freeway.
So Watsonville has a 25% unemployment rate?
It's somewhere between 20 and 25%, yeah.
Wow.
It's very low income, and it's agricultural, and it doesn't have much of a bourgeoisie
Not many opportunities other than working in the field. And so I'm assuming that the transportation in Watsonville isn't very good.
Well, for Watsonville itself, in the city, it's good. And then you can get along Freedom Boulevard or the express routes along the freeway to get up to Santa Cruz where there's more jobs. But to get service along the fields where the a lot of agricultural workers are, there is no bus service along San Andreas Road.
Hmm. And Peter, what changes would you like to see? And if there were improvements, do you think the public would take advantage of them?
Well, I would think that you don't need to have every one of the buses running up and down the freeway. You could have at least one go down San Andreas Road once an hour, and that thereby you also wouldn't need to have a special bus that went to La Selva Beach every 2 hours. You could at least have this one bus that would ran the length of San Andreas Road, and you wouldn't need a special bus that just went down every 2 hours. You'd have a regular bus going at least once an hour or once every half an hour that would then service the community of La Selva Beach.
And do you see
San Andreas Road and the state parks along there? Everybody that goes to the state park at Sunset Beach and also Manresa Beach and the KOA campground, they can't just park their car and have access to the Santa Cruz Beach boardwalk on rapid transit. They have to then get back in their cars and drive into Santa Cruz County, and then that way you have the blockage on the freeway of cars. Mm.
Well, thank you so much for calling in, Peter. Jeff, what would you say to Peter and people who live in that area who say this two-hour bus just doesn't make sense? And how common is something like this?
It's actually, unfortunately, very common. I mean, in the Bay Area, we just did the moving to work study, and we found that 51% of jobs are located near frequent transit. So the frequency, and one of my favorite bloggers, Jarrett Walker, always says frequency is freedom, and I actually really buy into that. But the thing is that, you know, if the bus only comes every 2 hours, it makes it really hard to get to where you want to go in a meaningful amount of time. So if you miss that bus, you have to wait 2 more hours, which makes it really hard to be on time for, you know, if you're going for a job interview or you're trying to get to a stable job where they'll cut you if they'll cut your job off if you don't show up. So, you know, this is a big issue, and around the country, this is the coverage thing is a big problem where people, you know, who need transportation options, who need frequent transportation options, don't have access to them because, well, as you know, Dan spoke about earlier, there's a land use problem as well. So you don't want these empty buses traveling around, but you don't also want to serve the population so they can get places. So it's kind of a conundrum.
Yeah, I mean, just jumping in here, another way to think about this is, you know, La Selva Beach, you know, looks like a beautiful beach. I'm looking at it on the web here. Probably wouldn't be settled much if it weren't for the auto. Let's say that we didn't have autos at all and we just only had transit. Then we would have a lot more clustering and a lot less kind of people living in places like La Selva Beach and maybe even in Watsonville. And so the reality is that the auto, despite all of its problems, has created all kinds of opportunities historically and continues to do so for all kinds of people, including the vast majority of people living in Watsonville and La Selva Beach, but it does leave people behind. The question is, what's the best solution? And I'm not sure that transit is the best solution for a place like La Selva Beach. I think that there are probably better solutions having to do with, as we get better at sharing information and joining up with people to share our cars, for example. And you know, I've done a lot of studies of I've done a fair amount of research in the area of kind of immigrants in the United States and their travel patterns. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some substantial fraction of immigrants living in the United States is a fairly low income. Many of them are seasonal farm workers, like many who live in Watsonville. And the reality is that these folks are engaging in all kinds of kind of cooperative, sometimes coerced, means of transportation to get around when they themselves may be undocumented and can't legally drive or don't have the money to afford a car. And I think paying attention to how people actually get around and trying to intervene on a regulatory basis, it would be theoretically a much better way to go than running empty buses every couple of hours.
What else did you find in terms of immigrants and farm workers specifically who live in the Central Valley, Dan?
Well, I mean, I myself have not studied immigrants in the Central Valley, although I can refer to a study that was done by Susan Handy and Kristen Lovejoy. Kristen, formerly at UC Davis in the doctoral program, and Susan Handy is there now as a professor there, who looked simply at how were people getting around, and it was all about getting access to a car. Mm-hmm. And some substantial fraction of their focus groups were people who lived in places like Watsonville and Fresno and so on, and were working in agricultural professions. And so you do have the reality of what people are doing versus some sort of theory about providing public transit that may not, in fact, help people. I do think we have a fundamental kind of issue in transit specifically, which is how do we allocate the dollars that we do have, and do we allocate them more towards what we see as the biggest needs, or can we politically do that and retain support for transit? And I think that's, again, it's a conundrum.
That is Dan Chatman. He is assistant professor of city and regional planning at UC Berkeley. And Jeff Wood is the new media director and chief cartographer at Reconnecting America. We're talking today about public transportation, specifically in low-income communities, but most communities, and how it affects economic mobility. And now I would like to welcome Debbie Hale to the show. Debbie is executive director of Contract Performance Goals and Objectives at the Transportation Agency for Monterey County, an independent agency whose mission is to fund, plan, and build projects that meet the needs of all Monterey County residents. Hi, Debbie. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
It's nice to have you. So we just got a call from Peter in La Selva Beach saying that they get buses in the area every 2 hours. And Dan was just saying that public transit might not be the best option for people living in La Selva Beach. So how do you deal with small places like this, and how do you meet the needs of those citizens?
Well, it's a real conundrum, meeting the needs of citizens in areas that are not as dense. If you only offer transit every 2 hours, then the ridership is not going to be as strong. And yet it's just not dense enough maybe to support more frequent service. It's a real issue for folks that perhaps are now moving out to suburbs that may be less expensive. I think Watsonville is another example of that, that you want these folks to be able to afford where they live, and yet transportation, having your own personal automobile, is very expensive. But if you're in a lower density area like La Selva Beach, it may not support transit usage. So it's really important to take a look at developing enough density around these key transit corridors and having affordable housing along those corridors, because a lot of those folks are the ones that need the transit usage.
You know, I'm glad you brought up suburbs, because I live in San Francisco, I tend to think of low-income neighborhoods as neighborhoods, but we're seeing poverty just explode in suburbs. In fact, in the Bay Area, suburban poverty has risen dramatically, almost 10 times over the past decade. And I'm just looking online right now. There are articles about how this is taking off in Atlanta and Chicago and major, major cities. So how do you deal with this? Because we're not talking about just city neighborhoods. We're also talking about lack of access in suburbs where more and more poor people are moving.
Well, the corresponding situation, I think, happens in what we call South Monterey County. And I think that the answer is really clustering these suburbs to make them more walkable and more transit friendly. So in Monterey County, which is a huge county, if you know how far South King City is, that's just about the center of the county. So we have small communities south of King City, maybe a few thousand people, and getting them to transit is really difficult because it's not cost effective. But if we can cluster our housing developments in the cities, if we can bring them at least as far north as King City, Greenfield, Soledad, and then have those communities be dense enough that they can be well served with regular transit lines, then I think we're addressing the issue of being able to pay for our transit and making it so that these folks can live in a lower cost community and yet still get to jobs in the major city centers such as Salinas.
And Dan, how would you respond to that question about how to deal with suburbs where we're seeing poverty rates increase?
I think it's always helpful to go back to, instead of looking at a pattern that has arisen, to think about what people are doing. And I say that because in the case of suburbanization, the suburbanization of poverty or poverty increasing in suburbs, one thing that is happening there is there is increasing demand by more affluent people to go to the center city. There's a little bit of that happening in places like the Bay Area and elsewhere. And so this is partially a cultural thing. It could be partially having to do with demographics of people with and without families, with and without children, and an aging population. And there's been a lot written on this. So then what happens? Well, then the relative costs may be lower in the suburbs than they were in the past. And the reason that poor people live in the suburbs is because poor people have cars.
Mm-hmm.
So, and if they don't have cars, they're still, you know, the most common mode of a household without a vehicle is driving, because they will borrow a car. So it isn't as though people don't have any options at all. The fact is that most people can drive. It's a dwindling number of people who do have to rely on public transportation, who have to rely on it to get around. And the costs are being driven down precisely because of the relative the relatively low cost of driving. So I have to come back to this point I made earlier, which is that the number one, there's 2 points to make here, I guess. The number one is that the auto really has been a major invention, which has really opened up development everywhere. And there's nothing really bad about that intrinsically, except that there is this kind of balance problem with people who, for whatever reason, can't drive. And secondly, there's another problem, which is a policy issue, which is that we don't pay the costs of our driving. We impose impacts on the climate and global climate change. We have we cause pollution, we cause congestion, so on and so forth. And all of these things are not reflected in the cost that we pay when we drive, and therefore we drive too much. So without dealing with that issue, I think it's sort of really tough to have transit compete, because transit, in other words, I don't think throwing money after transit is the way of solving the problem of the fact that auto use is too cheap. And I'm skeptical about the ability of outlying areas to be able to densify in this way. And it's a really tough thing to happen, because the market needs to be there. The cost of developing dense housing, all else equal, will be higher in places with low land costs. And so it's not going to be a market-supportable strategy, which in turn requires public subsidy, yet more public subsidy. And, Santa Cruz County and Monterey County, beautiful counties, agricultural counties, I do think that what we really need is more of a policy regime, ideally. This is never going to happen, probably, but which results in a more compact urban form regionally. And there would be fewer people living in Monterey County, and there would be fewer people living in Santa Cruz County, because those places are too far away. They're not efficient places to live in for most people. Hmm. And people probably shouldn't be doing two-hour commutes, because they're not paying the cost of those commutes.
Debbie, do you agree with that?
Well, I would just say it's important to remember that while many low-income households do have a car, they may have just one car. And I know that our transit district, Monterey Salinas Transit, has done surveys that show that the majority of their riders have only one car, or and a smaller percentage have zero cars, but that one income earner uses the car to get to work and the other income earner uses the bus. And so although many low-income households can afford to have a car, they can only afford to have one. Certainly the rising gas prices have had an impact on their ability to afford that second car. So I agree with the notion that drivers are not bearing the full cost of the automobile. They're not. The gasoline tax has not been raised since 1994. And so we're not covering the increases in inflation and construction costs that it costs to drive on the road, much less the costs of pollution that are caused by the automobile with our gasoline taxes. But we can't say, well, everybody can drive, and so we don't need to provide transit, when in fact, with the higher unemployment rates, fewer people have been able to afford to have that second car, and yet more households have had to have that second job.
And Debbie, before we let you go, we're going to take one call from Santa Cruz. So let's hear from Donald. Hi, Donald.
Oh, no, my name is Dominic.
Oh, sorry. Hi, Dominic.
Yeah, no worries. I agree with the notion, partly that, you shouldn't be commuting where, it's 2 hours away where you live. I mean, and that's easy in words to say, but it's not always available with inexpensive housing where employment's available. So, I mean, people have these long commutes because they have to drive places where they can't afford to live. As far as specific capital investment, I mean, there needs to be a strategic balance depending on where main veins of traffic are. And, I mean, maybe with gathering of data now, maybe Google or other tech companies might be able to strategically identify where the demand points in a metropolis are. I mean, in outside areas, I mean, I'm reminded every time I get a speeding ticket on, the ticket, that driving is a privilege, not a right, So, I mean, public transportation, like when I studied abroad in Rome, there was a form of public transportation on every single corner of some sort, train, underground, bus, trolleys, something. But when I asked for directions one time, I was given directions to take three different forms of transportation to get basically what would have been a three-block walk. So, I mean, in some cases, cultures become almost dependent or overly dependent, it seemed, on public transportation, where it would have been even a shorter amount of time to walk 3 blocks. But because so much transportation was available, that they almost became dependent on it, you know, so much where it was almost unnecessary. I mean, seeing buses drive around Santa Cruz that are natural gas, that does cut down on the cost of driving, like, you know, the other man mentioned. And, I mean, maybe cities would be able to subsidize electric car purchases for short driving around town, you know.
And do a lot of people take those buses?
I mean, you don't see a whole lot of people taking those buses, but I mean, if more is available, I mean, if natural gas lines were fed maybe straight to cities and it were cheaper for them and they could just provide, you know, these services where, I mean, you're still having to pay the bus driver's salary. Like I said, I mean, I'm not a industry transportation expert. I mean, it would be like think tanks that would be necessary. You know.
Well, let me get a quick response from Debbie. Thanks for calling, Dominic.
Sure. One of the best ways to help provide this accessibility to transportation is to have what's called transit-oriented development. This is most common around rail or bus rapid transit stations, but also just regular bus transit stations. If you can locate people within a half a mile of a major station area, then the likelihood that they will take transit increases tremendously. So I think a lot of this is about providing options for folks that may not be able to afford to take transit or afford to drive a car, but also providing options to those who may want to have the alternative. And in fact, that's part of why when Dan talked about people moving into the urban core, that's part of why they're moving into the urban core, so because they don't want to have to drive anymore. Well, let's provide some options for people who can't afford to drive near these transit centers, and that'll make it cheaper then to provide the transit, less cost to the cities, but more options for the traveling public.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Debbie.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. That is Debbie Hale, Executive Director of Contract Performance Goals at the Transportation Agency for Monterey County. And we've got just about 5 more minutes with Dan Chapman, Assistant Professor of City and Regional Planning at UC Berkeley, and Jeff Wood, New Media Director and Chief Cartographer at Reconnecting America. And we've got a number of callers on the line. If you want to try to get your comment or question in, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, or you can send us an email, and I'll get to a couple emails in a few minutes, feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from KDF in Oakland. Hi, KDF. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks. I've got a number of comments. You know, public means all of us, and Lyft, Uber, Sidecar require that people have fancy cell phones. I don't know how that serves low-income people. And
so, KDF, just to let listeners know who aren't familiar with those services, they're basically services where you click on an app and someone, a stranger in their own car, shows up in about 5 minutes and picks you up. And I'm going to propose a show about this. So I just wanted to let people know about it.
Good, good. Because, you know, they're creating a two-tier transportation system, one legal, one illegal. And Lyft, Uber, Sidecar, they're cheats. You know, medallioned and licensed San Francisco taxi cabs are required by law to each carry $1 million worth of commercial liability insurance. And, you know, these cheating cars that are pretending to be San Francisco taxi cabs don't. I'm going to be real interested to find out what's going to happen when one of their riders in these so-called share cars is seriously injured. Who in the world is going to pay
well,
their hospital bills?
KDF, thank you so much for calling. I hate to cut you off, but we're definitely going to do a show, I hope, about that, because cab drivers are also saying that it's incredibly difficult to make ends meet because of these services. So thank you so much for calling in. I just want to read a couple emails. Linda in El Cerrito writes, very important conversation. As an adult, I didn't drive until I was past 30 and then could not afford a car. Thank goodness for city public transit to get me to work. Does bus service have to mean a full-sized bus? I see large buses that are 90% empty and don't run often enough to make you want to take them. Why can't they run 2 smaller vehicles twice as often? Or is it the cost of employing the drivers, not the cost of buying and running the buses? Dan, do you know?
Well, the short answer is she's absolutely right. The cost of the drivers is the real issue. Typically, again, we're overcapitalized in public transportation. So in general, yes, smaller buses would work, and there's been some work on this, research on this, and they're more common in other countries, very, very common in other countries. But those are countries where the wage costs are lower.
We have another email from Sue who says, could the rich be encouraged to support public transit by packaging it as reducing traffic for themselves, get a lot of cars off the road by getting the poor into public transportation? I mean, what is the best way to really start this conversation? I mean, I know, Dan, you say not all forms of public transit are the right answer here. But how do you actually get people to at least talk about these issues?
Jeff, do you want to, you've thought about this.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, I think providing people with actually, you know, transit that works is probably the best way to start getting people to think about it. You know, part of the reason why the Ubers and the Lyfts have popped up is because there's been an issue with people who want to use, you know, frequent and fast transit. There's people in San Francisco and Oakland and other places who want to use really good transit, but are, you know, sometimes they're stuck waiting 40 minutes for a bus. And so I think that, you know, there's something to be said for providing really good transit service. There's a mention of Rome from a caller earlier, and I think that a lot of Americans go to Europe and then they're overwhelmed by the 5-minute headways in the major city centers of Europe. But, you know, when they come back, they're kind of disappointed that there's not a bus in the next 5 minutes. And so I think that the service quality, and if you improve that, I think more people will become, you know, they'll say, oh, this is a reliable form of transportation, and they'll be able to use it. So I think that, you know, changing the conversation includes changing the kind of the service quality and the investment in that, too.
And Dan, final thoughts from you, about 30 seconds?
I was going to say, regarding this issue of Lyft and other services, I think that they're complementary to transit. I think that these are what make it possible, taxis as well, make it possible for people not to own cars, so that when they need a car, they can do car sharing or bike sharing in addition to transit. Transit is not going to meet every need. We need a whole package of things together. And one last comment I would like to make is that it's really important to think about the notion of housing policy and affordable housing being an issue that drives people out to go far away and leads us to having this pattern that's hard to serve.
Yeah, I'll make a note of that. That would be another good show. Dan Chapman is Assistant Professor of City and Regional Planning at UC Berkeley, and Jeff Wood is the new Media Director and Chief Cartographer at Reconnecting America. Thank you both for joining us.
Thanks.
Thank you so much, and thank you for listening. And if you're free tonight, I'm moderating a discussion about bicycling following the screening of a film with My Own Two Wheels, which is a film about the bike as a vehicle for change around the world. Tonight, it's a free screening, 6 o'clock at the San Francisco Public Library. Find more information, yourcallradio.org. Thanks for listening. 12 years after 9/11, how has racial profiling changed? On the next Your Call, we'll talk about who's being profiled and what it's like to be profiled. Arab and Muslim Americans still make up a large percentage of the no-fly list. So what has changed since 9/11? Who's targeted? And what is the right way to evaluate security threats while protecting everyone's right to freedom and privacy? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with Hannah Baba and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.